Hi, I'm Samantha Cotterill, and I'd love to invite you to join me for my upcoming workshop, Paper Stories, Crafting 3D Dioramas for Illustration and Children's Books. This is a class about building tiny worlds. Imagine making a little theater stage out of paper and foam board, and then filling it with cutout trees, characters, skies, shadows, and finally bringing it all to life with light and photography. Over 2 weeks, I'll walk you through the whole process. You're going to learn how to sketch and design your scene, how to paint textures and play with paper, how to cut, fold, and build your stage, how to light your set like a little film studio, and finally, how to photograph it beautifully so it looks just as magical on screen or in print as it does in your hands. Don't worry if you've never done anything like this before. Everything is broken down step by step with videos, templates, plenty of encouragement, and lots of live interaction. By the end, you will have your very own finished 3D diorama, a miniature theater for your story to live inside. And the best part? We'll finish a little diorama party where everyone can share their creations, cheer each other on, and celebrate the joy of making something by hand. So if you love storytelling, illustration, or just the sheer delight of scissors, glue, and paper, come join me and let's build a tiny paper world together.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
And I'm Lee White.
And today we are interviewing Jason Chin. He is an illustrator based in Vermont. And you might know him from his Caldecott winning book, Watercress, and his Caldecott honor book, Grand Canyon. The book that I absolutely adore and love, I didn't get a chance to tell him this in the interview, is the one about the life of a whale and what happens
amazing
after a whale dies and how integral it is to the sea's ecology. But that's what's cool about, he's really found a niche in children's books, and it's like he's going to be the, he's like, I'll be the National Geographic reporter for children's books, essentially. Would you agree with that?
Good good analogy. He's doing basically nonfiction, or if it is fiction, it's kind of weaved into some non-fictional kind of topic.
Yeah, reality stuff.
Science kind of stuff, but then with sort of human heartstring tugging at your, family stories that are mixed in with the science. So it's not just an educational book like you get in a textbook or something.
Right, exactly. And what's cool about this interview too is we get into his sort of back history of how he went from art student to children's book illustrator. And some of the key things that he did, we kind of joke about some of the lucky stuff that happened with him, but the cool thing I think about this story of his is he totally made the luck happen. If he wasn't doing the things he was doing deliberately, he wouldn't have had some of these lucky breaks. And so we get into that. What was one of your big takeaways from this interview, Lee?
Like you said, he found where he fit perfectly, mm-hmm. and really just played in that lane. And that's sort of his thing. And he does the same thing. Yeah. It's very consistent sort of approach. I think he got into it before the, we talk about in the interviews, like social media and all this stuff, pulling you in all these different directions. He's not paying attention to that. He's doing his thing, and he does it really, really well.
Yeah. Yep. You know, if you compare it to us, it's like, two children's books. I'm done with children's books. I'm going to do a comic. Two comic books later.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I'm going to design a board game.
I'm all over the place.
He's
Right. Well, all the successful people that we've interviewed tend to have his model. We're that's why we're not successful.
you could do,
do stuff
a
all
lot
over
of
the
things
place.
Kind of well, or you could do one thing really well.
Right.
So, all right, let's jump into the interview.
I mean, that's a great starting point. So you started out in New York and then, and now you're in Vermont. How did that sort of path, just the big sort of overview of of sort of where you started and how you ended up where you are would be awesome.
Yeah. So it started for me, you know, in high school, actually, or maybe before that. So I grew up in New Hampshire, and I had, I lived in a small town that was the home of a picture book illustrator. Her name was Trina Sharp Hyman. I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but for the viewers,
I know that name. That sounds familiar.
This is her work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
There you go.
And she lived in your town?
She lived in my town. So, wow. Or I lived in her town. we moved there in 1987. I was in second grade, and she came to visit the elementary school every year. And she was kind of a local celebrity. She won the Caldecott Medal in 86. So I moved there. I didn't know this. I didn't know what the Caldecott was, but, then she came to present at our school, and then I learned, oh, you can get medals for art. That's awesome.
And you were you already drawing at that point?
All of our stories. We were the class artists when we were kids, right?
Not me. I didn't draw as a kid. So I'm jealous.
You came to it later.
I didn't draw until I was an adult at all. Like zero. Wow. And so it's always interesting to me to hear people like you and Jake, like where you're in your rooms, you know, copying comic books or whatever. Yeah. I just, I'm jealous of that.
Oh, that's cool. Well, many of our stories.
Yeah. Yeah. Lee was the class punk. I've seen the pictures of you in high school. And
it wasn't pretty.
That's not, I mean, that's awesome that you found art and you can bring your story to the table. I mean, you know, a lot of artists bring their artist story to the table and.
Yeah. Yes. So you're doing all this art in high school and you see this presentation did you know immediately, like, I want to do illustration, or was it just sort of art?
Yeah. Yeah, well, what happened was I liked her books. I like, you know, picture book art was a lot of the art that I looked at, as many kids, you know, that's where they are introduced to art. And I had her art, you know, I had her books. And in high school, I called her up and asked her for help with a project, or asked her actually just if she'd look at my artwork. And she was very gracious and kind and agreed to, and ended up helping me a lot. You know, she became my mentor. So that was in high school, and by the end of high school, I knew I wanted to go to art school. I didn't know for sure I wanted to do picture books. I kind of knew that, you know, I had this experience with art, but wanted to learn different ways or different things. I didn't want to pigeonhole myself. I kind of was aware of that as a possibility. So, you know, you have this mentor and then you just kind of get on that train and
Right. Okay. So the takeaway, we like to do takeaways. So the takeaway for the listener is find the Caldecott winner in your town.
Yeah, that's right.
And ask them.
And ask a friend.
Right.
Okay. Awesome.
Reach out to artists. You know, if you're a kid or if you're in school, you're in high school or college, reach out to artists and ask them to look at your work. I think
that's awesome. So did she? She was obviously very encouraging because you didn't.
Yeah, and I found out kind of later as I got older and got to know more people that she was very influential in the lives of many artists.
That's cool.
Yeah. That's awesome. So for example, do you know the artist David Wiesner?
Mm-hmm. No, who's that?
Wrote the book or wrote, it was a wordless picture book. So he illustrated the book Tuesday, the Caldecott winning book Tuesday, and many other wordless picture books.
Flotsam and like.
Right. Three-time Caldecott medal winner.
Mm-hmm. Crazy.
So crazy. Yeah. She gave David his first job. She met him in our school.
Oh, and nice.
Basically launched his career, or, you know, was that stepping stone. Just as one example, there are many more, but I'm constantly running into people who are like, oh, you worked with Fina? Like, she helped me out here.
That's so cool that she has that lineage of
Very, very cool, yeah. And so anyways, I count myself very lucky to have been connected to her and had her help. She was so influential for me.
So did you stay on the East Coast when you went to college, or where'd you go to school?
I went to school at Syracuse University and studied there in the illustration program.
Were you? Did you study with Murray Tinkleman, by any chance?
Yeah, Murray was. So I was kind of at Syracuse at the end of his tenure there. He left a few years after I graduated.
Interesting.
Did you know Sam Cotterill too?
No, I did not. I only know her, basically know her from the podcast, but mostly.
Okay.
Aware of her books,
yeah, right.
But really got to.
I wasn't sure if you two crossed paths or not. So
yeah, oh, so she. So, I didn't know she was at Syracuse.
I think that isn't that where she went to.
I believe so, but I don't know if the years were the similar. I'm not sure.
Right. I know her son goes there now. So
right.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The other professor that there were other professors there, but the one who actually took over the program shortly after Murray left was James Ransom, who is children's picture book illustrator, has been doing it for a long time. And he was the head of the program, and I got to know him through kind of the picture book industry after the fact, but he was there for a long time, so maybe Sam would know him.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, I studied with Murray at my graduate program. He was running the Hartford program when I did.
Right, yeah, so, okay, right. Yeah, so that's where he went after Syracuse, the Hartford program.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you finish your degree, and you are focused on picture books. How many have you done up to this point? How quick was it when you got out of school to get your first book?
20-ish. So there are some work for hire books in there in the beginning that are out
that's
of print.
That's pretty-ish. Yeah, everybody has those. I don't
necessarily talk about. and it's not, you know, people ask, you know, if you say, you know, I did 21 books, you know, four of them they'll never find.
Right.
So after college, I moved to New York City, and I got a job at a children's bookstore called Books of Wonder, which a lot of people are familiar with. Mm-hmm. So I was a bookseller there. And it happened that many of us were aspiring illustrators, authors, and editors. So
I always thought it'd be cool to work at a bookstore. Like, I have this fantasy that since I'm basically self-employed, I just get a like afternoon job at a bookstore and just go there for a few days a week.
It's not a bad idea. I mean, to see all the books and be around all the time.
Yeah. I know a lady who works at, a picture book creator that works at my local indie sometimes. But it was a great education. I consider it kind of the last piece of the puzzle in my education. Because at Syracuse, they were the professors' backgrounds were kind of editorial, more editorial than picture books. I know Murray did picture books and the other professors did as well, but they weren't in the children's literature community. They were more
correct. They just happened to do a children's book. Yeah.
We're hired to do some books. In fact, one of the professors said to me, you know, I like doing books, except for they put words all over my artwork and I don't like that. I'm like, well, okay. You know, I learned that books of wonder that the words matter. Right. Obviously.
Right.
But I never really had that education or that introduction to the picture book as an art form in school, mm-hmm. except I took a bookmaking class with a printmaker, which was awesome. And it like, that's actually the reason I went. I was like, all right, books are something I really actually care about and love, because mm-hmm. we're making the paper and binding print, using the letterpress and stuff. But that made me think, oh, books are where I want to be with my art. And going, you know, getting the job at Books of Wonder taught me about the art form. In the history.
And were you already doing your own dummies, or how did the first
Not
couple
yet,
books come out?
No. I had a portfolio, you know, my school portfolio, and being surrounded by other aspiring creators, you know, picture book creators, was just, you know, probably the best part. It was kind of like, you know, I left art school but didn't leave the whole art community of the all the students there, you know what I mean? That I know, like, a lot of artists leave art school, or art students leave school and then are kind of on their own, and they lose that community, and you kind of lose the motivation or the all of the benefits that come from that, being around,
right.
surrounded by artists, right? But I gained that at the bookstore, and many of us have gone on to be published authors and have a career in children's publishing. So that was a really special place to be at that time. So that was that. I ended up, so I got some work for hire books, like I said, or some kind of entry level small publisher jobs that were really great. Great for me to learn about how to do a job, you know, great
right.
introduction to illustrating a book. And I learned a lot. My portfolio, my art skills were not ready for prime time.
I mean, that's kind of important to hear from. Yeah. It's important to hear that, because a lot of people think, oh, you go to art school and then you're just ready. And that's what I thought too. And then I realized that it really is a long sort of marathon of putting all the pieces together, getting one skill but still not having the other. And then there's storytelling skills sort of come later too, even after you
right.
figure out the art stuff and the technique stuff. And it's just funny because everybody thinks, oh, if I do my first book, this is the most important one, and this is the one that has to be perfect. And you realize there's a few you sort of cut your teeth on that aren't the greatest books of all time, but you're learning the craft, over that time frame. So I think it's important for people to hear that. It's not just one and done. You go to school and then you're just, oh, I'm a professional illustrator and everything's great.
Yeah, it's so true. It's, I'll say there was one... In addition to having to do more art and really hone skills, right? There's like a craft of it that I had to work on. And then there was the knowledge of picture books and storytelling and how the art form works that I didn't, was figuring out reading all the books at the store and talking to people. There was one piece of the puzzle that I really didn't get. There was an incident that kind of flipped the switch for me, which was I had the opportunity to show my portfolio to an editor, and a well-known editor. It was like a big deal. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, I get a face-to-face meeting with this editor, not just drop off your portfolio, they'll look at it and talk to you, whatever. It was a big deal. So I bring it in, face-to-face meeting. He looks through the portfolio and he says, okay, what do you want to do? I was like, I want to make art and get paid for it.
Right.
So I mean, that's, you know, that was where my head was at the time. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a good answer for him. And it, and I left realizing, man, I missed, it felt like a missed opportunity. But there was a big takeaway from that, which was, I realized that I needed to bring something more to the table than just a person who is able to make a picture of anything, just a skilled drawer, painter that could illustrate your book for you. That he was looking for,
right,
someone that cared about what the pictures they were making and to learn what that artist cared about. And so I really I went back to the drawing board, I guess, so back to my art table thinking, okay, I'm not just going to make pictures that fill some, slot in the portfolio. Like, I'm not going to make picture of I don't have a night scene in my portfolio. I should add one. Or I don't have, an old man and a young.
Right. Sort kid. Of like, it's like making a sandwich. Oh. If you're at a deli, you're like checking the boxes. Okay. I got this one and I got that one. And
I went back and said, what do I care about? I'm going to make art about what I care about.
Mm.
And I'm going to look and pay attention in my world outside of art, what I care about. Not just I love this artist. I'm going to copy them. Or
right. Yeah. What was the answer that you came to with that question?
Yeah. So what happened? It was intentional, but it was a process of discovery. And what happened was I was on the subway one day, and I read a magazine article about redwood trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got really absorbed in this article, and it just stuck with me. The way that, when something captures your imagination or your interest, it just kind of sticks in your mind. And I kept thinking about these trees, and I thought maybe I could make a book about these trees. Yeah, there it is, redwoods. Yeah, I got it behind me too there. I just started putting together a book dummy about this subject, not as much focused on the art I wanted to make, but the story I wanted to tell, and trying to learn to make the art to serve the story, right? To serve something outside of itself. And that was just a total game changer for me. And that what I showed it to a friend at Books of Wonder, who showed it to his editor. He had been published by Neil Porter. That's my editor now. His name is George O'Connor. I don't know if you know George's work. He does a series called The Olympians, graphic novels of Greek myths, the Olympians series, which is done now. He's done all 12 Olympians.
Wow, that's huge. That's so much work.
One book for each. Yeah, he was working on it for a long time. And now he's doing Norse myths, which is going to... Actually, he's been on that for a few years.
Staying in his lane.
Yeah, I mean, he does other things too. He does... what was... I'm blanking on these other... comics he illustrates, Awesome Man or something, comics for young readers.
Yeah.
But that's kind of his bread and butter, are the Greek myths, Norse myths. Anyways, he was doing that with Neil, and then I at Roaring Brook Press, he said, "Well, do you mind if I show your book dummy to my editor?" And I'm like, "Do I mind? Please do." and that's how
this is the Redwoods book dummy.
This is the Redwoods book dummy, which was pencil sketches and a manuscript. I was 20, let's see, that was 2007. So, I was in my late 20s.
To put it in chronological
order,
years
after 28, maybe.
The takeaway is, first, step one, talk to the Caldecott-winning person in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then step two is show your book dummy to your friend who has a famous editor.
Yeah. There's so many pieces of my like story that are so lucky.
Yeah, I mean that's like, definitely in the luck. But you're doing the work though. I mean that sort of is the illustrated example, so to speak, of preparation meets opportunity, right? And
well, there's two parts there. It's because a lot of times people are like, you know, a lot of artists I know just want to stay inside and do their thing and not do the networking or the friend making or go out and, you know, put themselves out there and just hope that their artwork gets discovered. I've missed the part. How did you become friends with Greg?
George. Yeah.
O'Connor.
Yep. George. So he was the shipping department at the bookstore. His job was boxing books and unboxing books, and you know,
it's really that's a good point, though.
It'd be
interesting. You know, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, it's really you have to do the work, right? You have to learn to make the art. You need to hone your craft. But you know, art is made. It's about communication, and you have to find the people that want to. You know, pay you for it, hopefully, and share it with people. And
wouldn't it be interesting if everybody had to do 3 years at a bookstore? If you like, say, if you want to be a children's book illustrator, it's mandatory. That kind of like a requirement that you work at a bookstore for 3 years.
That would be killer. I did.
Not any bookstore. I mean, like, I take that back. Any bookstore is great, but. For me, it was the piece of the puzzle that made it more different than any other bookstore was that the people there cared about children's books.
You know? Right. Books of wonder.
So you go into Barnes & Noble, and sometimes the bookseller in the children's section is just doesn't really care that much.
Right, right.
Lee, have you been to Books of Wonder before?
I have.
It's such a special bookstore. Like, it's almost like I have to stop there every time I go to New York City just because it's number one, they have a great collection, great assortment of books, but they also just are so about the craft and the artistry and the community of it. So it just always feels like something's going on at that place.
They do a lot of events, and I mean that was another part of it that was special was that all of the New York based authors and illustrators that had, which is a lot, that had a new book would come through, and they would have a Caldecott event every year, and the Caldecott winner was there signing books. So
that's cool.
You know, Van Allsburg and Macaulay and Wiesner and go down the list. McClintock and I think Jane Yolen came. Well, she's an author, but she came in. I don't know. Julie Andrews came in. She wrote a children's book.
Wow. Wow,
<that's laughs> awesome. I have books for Julie Andrews.
I mean, you just sort of named, minus Maurice Sendak, you sort of named
Sendak,
I don't know if he came through, if you ever met him, but you.
I did, yeah.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, so
the Mount Rushmore of illustrators right there.
That's true.
Allsburg, Sendak, Wiesner, and, you know, fill in the gap for the fourth one. But
So Maurice Sendak didn't come to the store. He wasn't doing public appearances, but he had a relationship with the store and the owner, and allowed the owner to drive boxes of books up to his house to have him sign them. And then, so then I was like the assistant on one of those trips to his house, which was awesome.
Oh my goodness.
It was amazing. He's like, get out of here. What are you doing here? It's your books, Mr. Sendak. Okay, fine.
He was so funny. He was hilarious. He was a very
I mean, I will. I just want to take a second to. I mean, every city isn't going to have a bookstore like that, but you will have every. At least every city that I've been to, I always check out the independent bookstores, and almost every city I have been to, a bigger city, has had something close to that. Like when I was in LA, like every picture tells a story in Storyopolis. And then when I was in Nashville, I mean, like every, and Portland had a couple of them, Green Bean Books and a few different ones. So I do want to just take a moment for this public service announcement to, if you haven't gone to your independent bookstores in your city or the cities around you, go check them out and support these bookstores. I mean, they can be amazing places like you're talking about. And that one's sort of the pinnacle of it, but they're all so good. And the one thing that has been consistent is everyone is so into it. I mean, they are not there just to get a paycheck. They love this stuff. And it's incredible. And they know especially if you've been, they have author and artist signings. Jake did an event at Green Bean Book. Check these things out because I do think that we've become a society that is, oh, I'll just stay online. I'm just going to stay in my room. I'm going to just stay where I am instead of getting out and supporting your local community. And you're kind of a classic example of, oh, I met this person, and you're not meeting them for gain. Like, what can they do for me? But it's just sort of this, how things happen. Like, oh, this person knows this person and all the pieces sort of play out. But the intent is just genuine connection. And that's the starting point. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've been like kind of naming all these artists, right, that have big names in children's literature coming through. But they don't just go to New York, right? So I live in Burlington, Vermont, and the local independent bookstore in the smaller town next to Burlington had Barnett and Mac Barnett and John Clausen come through. And John Cheska came through, and Lauren Long came through, if you know their names.
Oh, yeah.
So Burlington's not a big city. And so I imagine that all around the country there are artists and illustrators and
yeah, you just have to get on the newsletters, the email list for the bookstores.
They'll
tell you who's coming through.
Right.
So I want to change gears just for a second. I want to eat my dessert. I've been waiting for this sort of topic. All these books are great. Every one of your books are great, but there's one that's different than the rest of them so far. And that is this one with the circles on it.
Yeah.
I want to talk about these circles. So we're looking at a book called Watercress. And so Jason's done a bunch of books. He's obviously living the life of a picture book author, illustrator. And this book, obviously, we're looking, if you're watching the YouTube channel, there's a Caldecott circle on there. I don't have my glasses on, so I can't see the other ones. Is that a Society of Illustrators
sticker? It is a Caldecott medal, a Newbery honor, and an Apala award. Apala is a group, the Asian Pacific Islander Librarians Association.
Gotcha.
Which is part of... It's like a subset of a American Library Association.
Okay. So this has really the trifecta. The Newbery gold, silver, and the Caldecott. Yeah. It's amazing. And so Jake and I were just chatting about it because it's every illustrator's dream to have these stickers on the front of their book. And we wanted to talk about sort of how this played out because we don't know, because we're just lowly illustrators without the circles on our books. Early did you know? So Watercress is published. When it was in development, were your editors and art directors, was there already a buzz about this book, or was it just another one in the sequencing? I mean, of course you're trying to make them all Caldecott winners. We all are. But was there a buzz about it, or how did this sort of unfold?
There was, no buzz or talk of awards during the creation or the during my work. You know, don't think about awards when you're making artists.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's good, because my first sentence on my pitches is always, this will win a call to cut. And they don't like that. Just,
you know, it's not why you should make art.
Right.
It's not a competition. Right. So that, you know, that's that. During production, you know, nobody talks about awards or anything. I think what we think about, the author and I and the editor, art director, always is just making a meaningful book for the child reader, for the kids. Mm-hmm. So it's always like, is this going to be a good book for a kid? Is this going to be meaningful or, for the reader? So that's where the focus is during the creation of the book. After it's out and, you know, we have copies before it's on sale, then the publicity team is bringing it to stores and libraries, mm-hmm. and trying to get people to order it and keep it on the shelves. And then bring it to reviewers. So there's a review process that starts before the book is, after it's printed or when it's being printed. Some reviewers review from from PDFs. Or from what's called F&Gs. It's called Fold and Gathers. It's printed pages that have been folded up but not bound yet. Right. So they have, there's no cover on it. It's all just folded pages kind of nested together. So there's the review process that happens early on. And I think that kind of starts to set the stage for the kind of awards committees to start looking at books. So they're all different awards out there, but we'll talk about the Caldecott Newbery. Those committees are reading books all year long. Mm-hmm. So they're reading hundreds and hundreds of books. And Caldecott is looking at illustrated books, which are primarily picture books. Newbery is looking at primarily chapter books. So they have a much bigger task to read hundreds of books. So they have their system for doing it. They keep their whole system and the committee's deliberations and how they come to their decision. That's all kept under wraps. So I don't know how they came to their conclusion. But there are 15 people on the committee and they all have to agree. On mm-hmm. So they have a whole system for coming to their consensus.
So do you know that this review process is happening? And do you have any?
Yeah, I know. You know, it happens every year. Yes, I know it's happening now for 2020.
Well, but I mean, was there any? Did you have any idea that this book was in contention? When was the first that you got wind of that?
So it depends on. Not depends. You get an idea of, the buzz if books are getting lots of positive reviews and starred mm-hmm. reviews. So I'll refer your listeners to your past podcast episode about starred reviews.
Right.
Explain that, which I listened to, which was great. In brief, these publications like The Horn Book or Kirkus will review books and give them positive or maybe not so positive reviews. And for certain books every issue, they will select out as to give a star. It doesn't, if you get a star, it's really good. You're like, mm-hmm. they really liked your book. It's not like a 1 out of 5 stars.
Right. So, a star or not a star.
A star or not a star. That's it, right? Yeah. So Watercress received a lot of starred reviews. Just most of, I think, almost all of the major review publications gave it a star, as I remember. Mm-hmm. And nothing like that had happened. You know, a lot of my books get a starred review or a couple of starred reviews. This one got like 6 or 7 or something like that, which is...
That's huge.
There are 6 or 7 review publications or maybe eight. I don't. They're all my ones, and I can't. I don't know. Right. I try not to pay too much attention to it, to be honest.
But you are starting to notice. Hey, well, this is a good book.
Whoa, that's big. Now, that doesn't translate into an award. It's the 15 people on the committee's opinion, you know, about which mm-hmm. book to give the award to. But when a book gets a lot of star reviews like that, you can be pretty sure it's in the conversation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's a win. That's a huge win in itself.
Right.
To be in the conversation is, you know, I don't know the numbers of how many picture books are published every year, but it's in the thousands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's too many. To be in the conversation of like, you know, a couple hundred books that are being talked, you know, considered or.
Right.
Right. That's huge. And huge for, say, not necessarily, yes, for sales, for library sales, it's huge. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily put your book on the New York Times bestseller list. it doesn't turn, you know, it doesn't mean it's going to stay in print forever.
Right.
But it's really huge for feeling like you're, it's very validating. And that's huge for any artist. It's very validating.
So moving into Call to Cut season, and obviously they're doing these mock Call to Cuts. For those of you guys who don't know.
Yeah, those are like November, December.
Right.
The mock Call to Cuts are happening in schools. And
right. And they pick them, and I'm sure yours.
Wait, what? Explain that. What's a mock Call to Cut?
So it's the ones that I know about are most are happening in schools, in classrooms. So the librarian at the school will say, okay, we're going to do a mock Caldecott unit. All the kids in the school are going to read 10 books that the librarian selects, you know, mm-hmm. and the librarian will select some nonfiction books, some funny books, some more serious books, a variety that are kind of, you know, in the, you know, have the buzz or whatever, mm-hmm. could be the one. And then has all the kids read them throughout, you know, November. And then in December, the school kids will vote. This is actually the best part about the Caldecott and awards to me, is that it gets kids looking at art and discussing mm-hmm. the art. Because they go into the library and they say, oh, I like this one because I like the way that the artist used color to convey mood. And it gets kids thinking that way, and it's a great way to teach visual literacy. So that's what the mock Caldecotts are. And some of the publications, like some of the blogs, will do their own mock Caldecotts or the readers who are librarians and teachers will vote.
Gotcha.
And do their thing. So that's in like November, December, and then the Caldecotts are announced in January, and the mm-hmm. Caldecott committee decides the weekend of the ALA conference. They get together and they do their voting and go through the process over that weekend. They've been talking before that and having meetings. So, you know, again, this process is kind of opaque. Purposefully, it's not like...
Right.
Supposed to be widely known how it works, but they decide that weekend, and then they tell the artist traditionally on Monday morning, several hours before the award is announced to the public.
So can you describe that phone call? Is it a phone call that you got?
Traditionally, a phone call. We were still in kind of the tail end of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. when Watercress won. So they were meeting virtually, and so they weren't all in the same room. So they decided to have a Zoom call. Mm. So
gotcha.
To set it up, to make sure that I was going to come onto the Zoom call at the right time. They told my editor to ask if I'd do a presentation at ALA, you know, and present my next book.
Okay. So they're keeping it under wraps. They still want to make it.
So then I got on Zoom, like sitting right here in my studio, and I had like my book ready to show and some artwork to hold up. And I was getting all prepared and I was preparing what I was going to say. And then this, and I was like, hey, everybody, you know, like starting to talk, and they were like, shh, be quiet. We have something to say. And then they read, there's kind of like an announcement. It kind of goes like, on behalf of the committee, they read the committee name and ALA, we would like to inform you that you are the recipient of the Randolph Caldecott Medal.
No way.
Oh my goodness.
So they have, and they hit record. So there's a video of me. You know, jaw dropping, like speechless.
I mean, how did that feel? Yeah, I mean, what?
Like all the emotions, like, you know, joy and surprise and a little bit of not fear, but like a little apprehension too. Like, this is a big a big moment. You know, you know, just gratitude. That would, you know, when the, you know, all the emotions started to settle, it was gratitude. It's a big one. Actually, I thought a lot about Trina because, so this is her Caldecott book, and this desk, you can't see the desk online, but this is, I inherited her desk after she passed away.
Oh wow.
So
wow.
I painted it, and her desk is my desk. It's my desk now, but it was hers. So it was just like, you know, this is the desk that book was painted at.
Right. No. It's the Caldecott desk. Now we all need that desk.
So there, that's the last tip for your listeners.
Magic Caldecott desk.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just felt, it was like that whole, like, thing. I don't know. You know, when I was a kid and I learned about the Caldecott, I told you, I was like, oh, you can get medals for art? Awesome. I want one. And then as you grow up, you learn, oh, art actually isn't a competition. It's not about medals. It's not about, you know, on the one hand, you're always trying to improve your art. And you guys use the phrase level up a lot, which is which is great. But the only caveat to that is that art isn't really like a linear set of levels to attain, right?
Right.
It's a journey, it's a path, whatever. And it's not a competition. And so you don't, you know, I learned in my career, I'm not actually making art to win something or to be the best at something. I'm making art for the reader. I'm making art about something, redwood trees, that I care deeply about. And the point of the art is to communicate that feeling or ideas. And so
I love how humble you are about winning this and sharing sort of the win with the other people that sort of built your career up or that helped you. I feel like if I got this phone call, I would do the Rocky run where I run through my.
Yeah. Well, there's a little bit of that too.
I feel like there's a statue of me on top of some stairs.
So one of the thoughts for me, because I found out on Saturday night. So one of my thoughts was like, if listeners don't know, Andrea Wong, who wrote the book, wrote this book based on a childhood experience. So it's semi-autobiographical. Mm-hmm. So the whole time I was illustrating it, I was, you know, very aware that I was putting the author in her own book, which is
right.
And so this is a very personal story to her. It wouldn't exist without her. It's not just it's more than a book that she wrote. It's a book she wrote about herself. And so, you know, I there is a little feeling of like, wow, I'm going to get this huge award for Andrea's story. Right. So when she received a Newbery honor for the book, that's the silver medal that's on there.
Yeah.
That kind of like, that was like the Rocky run. Right. She called me the next day and said, our book has a Newbery honor. And it was like, you know, that was when it was just like confetti.
Yeah, huge.
So I got to celebrate with her. We both got recognized. It was awesome.
I wanted to ask you, Grand Canyon actually won a honor.
It did. Yeah.
So what was the difference between receiving an honor versus receiving the award?
Well, emotionally similar, because when I was told about the honor, I was like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, this is the pinnacle. It's never going to get any better than this. Like it was just, and I wrote that book. So, there was a little bit more like Rocky run, right?
Right.
a little bit less like, humility, I guess. The Caldecott medal is, it's another level in terms of, it's been going for like 80 something years, right? So there have been 80 medals given. And they're repeat winners, so maybe 60 people have received. Mm-hmm. I mean, 60 awards have been given out, but they give out like 4 honors every year. And but the medal, I guess it was like looking like, oh, the Polar Express won this. Mm-hmm. Where the Wild Things won this. Go down the list of my, you know, the Snowy Day. Right. On this, like the Mount Rushmore of children's books, and it's this book is on that list. My name is on the list with
Watercress,
and it's that now is like a whole. It's hard to believe. Still,
I mean, so
it's been a few years.
So after you won, that was 2021. So after you won, I'm curious about how your relationships changed in the industry. Was there an expectation on you that maybe wasn't there before? Did your career change in terms of finances? Like all of a sudden, like, well, this is a Caldecott winner, so let's throw a bunch of money at him. Was there more offers?
Yeah, there was some big changes. I would say after around the time of the Caldecott honor for Grand Canyon, I was like, okay, I feel stable. I feel like financially stable. I like it took some pressure off of like the hustle that was happening anyways before that. But it like that, the medal kind of really like
sealed it,
made me confident. Okay. This is going to be a stable career. Anyway, so that was that. I think the Caldecott medal also did that, and then also it does change things. You walk into the room as people know the book and your name, so there is a little shift to One Newbery, I met a lady who won the Newbery, and she said, "Oh, it's like having the green jacket from whatever the golf green jacket."
The Masters, yeah.
Masters. Well, like you're always welcome in any
right. And in the children's every book. Every you know. Book moving forward, it's by Caldecott winning medalist Jason
yeah.
Chin,
yeah.
not
yeah, yeah.
just right. illustrator yeah. Jason Chin.
Right. And so there's the financial benefit, which is like every library in the country. Then maybe not now. I don't know. buys the book. And so that's, yeah, that's a windfall for sure.
Yeah.
Which then, oh, and the book stays in print forever. That's mm-hmm. another thing is that, mm-hmm. You know, it's not going to be a bestseller forever. People are going to forget about it. You know, I mm-hmm. don't know all of the Caldecott winners from the 40s, but they are still in print and they're still available. And mm-hmm. that story will stay
that's
available
cool.
on our shelves.
That's got to be so gratifying to know that that's, ever. Yeah, that's, it's always going to be there. It's always going to be in the conversation. Like
yeah.
it's.
Yeah, that's really, it's one of the other ones, like that, like looking back at the past winners and being like, wow, I'm connected to them through this. And then looking forward to say, oh, it's going to be there, you know, after I'm gone. That,
right.
That's yeah. kind of.
Legacy, so to speak.
No, a legacy. And yeah, that's hard to wrap my mind around and very special.
Let me,
so is it harder to go through? Oh, go ahead, Jake.
You go ahead. And then I got to follow
I was just going to say, is it harder to go through, assuming you get more offers now, mm-hmm. so is it harder to sort of pick and choose what the next projects are going to be? Or are you just mm-hmm. saying, okay, I'm going to write all my own from now on? Or so how do you navigate what the future yeah. is once you have that?
Well, I've been working with the same editor since Redwood, so 15 years. With the same
oh, wow.
editor and art director. He moved to a new publisher. I went with him. And we have a good rhythm and it's been very successful, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I'm not interested in changing that. I love working with him. I love the rhythm we're in. So I illustrate a book by another author and then I write and illustrate my own. I go back and forth.
Oh, interesting.
I have kind of a comfortable pace that's working. I do get itches to do a different kind of art sometimes. And other author offers do come in, but so far I haven't taken offers with other publishers. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm very comfortable with my publisher where I'm at, and it's good, it's working. But I guess one of the reasons I started listening to your podcast is that you talk about art that's not children's literature and the different avenues for illustration and the different perspectives on illustration. And I'm so enmeshed and I've been so focused on children's literature and the library world and the school and library world and bookstore world. Where it's just so refreshing to hear people talk about comic books and going to Comic-Con or like making games.
Right.
Like doing a Kickstarter and making a game with your art. And I was like, oh, yeah, there's all these other ways.
do you make other art on the side, aside from children's stuff, just for personal work, or what's that look like?
Yeah, I'll show you. It looks like
we're getting a tour of the studio right yeah. now. Oh, wow, that's like gorgeous.
Watercolors. Oh, I've nice. Been trying to learn how to paint watercolor.
I love it. Are most of your books in watercolor?
Yeah, they're all in watercolor. Except for
so you're
this
still
one
trying
is
to learn.
Pen and ink in watercolor. This is pen and ink in watercolor.
That'll show you guys how hard watercolor is it takes for, even after he's done a million books, he's still trying to learn watercolor. I don't think you could ever get to the end of that.
Yeah, so here's how I got listening to the podcast. I was at a conference in a... SCBWI. Do you know that one? Mm-hmm. So it's for aspiring, like beginning people who are trying to get into breaking into children's books.
Yep.
And a attendee asked me a question about style and like how to discover her style or how to develop her style or, and, you know, I started to give, you know, one thought on that. And then another artist interrupted and said, oh, don't pay attention to style. Just pay attention to, you know, make your art what you love and your style will emerge or whatever. Mm. And so I was like, you know, this is an interesting kind of question or debate, right? Like, how do you reach style? So I was like, I wonder if anyone else has talked about this. If I discovered your episode of style. And I was like, that's a great discussion. What else do I have to say? And so I started listening to all the other discussions. And I was like, nice. This is so useful for me because I don't, these are like discussions that I would have if I had more artists to talk to who are just doing art. Like right. I talk about books and children's literature a lot and how books, words and pictures work and which books are working and which ones I love. But not just like the nitty gritty about like, how do you make a picture? Like what makes a good line? What makes a good palette as we were discussing? Right. And then Lee, you talked about, I don't know what it was, just going on this journey of rediscovering watercolor or trying to relearn how to paint watercolors. You did a workshop. I really understand it, right? I was like, yeah, that resonates. So that really resonates with me because I have a way of doing it that, you know, I was trained in picture making at Syracuse generally, but not specifically in watercolor. Mm. And I want to know, like, you know, I found a paper that I like, that I just do it always on that. But like, I want to know, like, what are the other papers?
Yeah.
Right.
More so I have these colors that I use all the time, but like, what about the other ones? And like, why would I don't know.
It's, mm-hmm. I mean, it's endless. When, I mean, that's exactly the question of why I started building the Watercolor Essentials workshop that I did is because I test all that stuff. And so I started making a notebook and a log of how things react differently. And because watercolor, unlike all the other mediums, is so dependent on technique and materials working together in a certain way. And if you pick the wrong paper or the wrong pigment or the wrong brush, it will not do the thing you want it to do. Whereas acrylic and oil, you can just keep layering and all that stuff. So I definitely have a kinship with you there. I wanted to go deep and understand it. I felt like I was sort of just guessing. And I, like you, I had my certain materials that I would stick with. But I was like, I'd see some other artists and I'd be like, how are they getting that look? So, you know.
And I've been doing like a kind of a more of going on Pinterest and just looking at other watercolor artists who are just watercolor artists, not, you know, for my
picture book, right.
You know, for the last 15 years, I've been looking at picture book artists and how they make pictures for picture books and what's working there. And I've developed my own, you know, opinion, technique, and approach, I guess, around that. You know, and I have ideas how to construct a narrative in pictures in 32 pages and how the picture should interact with the words and what's in, you know, I have all that kind of knowledge base, but I never developed knowledge base of how other people do watercolor.
How like, you, like,
you know, the difference between Wyeth watercolor and Reed, what's his name? Charles Reed watercolor. Like, what are they doing differently? And I've never gone deep.
I would have taken a Charles Reed workshop when he was alive. Yeah. He just passed away a few years ago. And missed out on that opportunity. So I'm right there with you. I'm starting to take live workshops from other people, and it's amazing. I mean, that's what I'm always encouraging people on the podcast now, is to get out and study with somebody, because like that Mark Foley workshop I did last year, it was a 3-day workshop. There was just one moment that what he did, and he wasn't even talking about what he was doing. He was just doing his thing. Yeah. And I saw what he did, and I was like, oh man, I'm taking that. And it like has shifted how I think about my watercolor. And I realized that there's, you know, you're not going to get everything from a workshop. Like the whole time is not going to be like, oh, that's new and that's new and that's new. It's going to be little bits that sort of like click, you know what I mean? That change your application. I feel like there's an art, there's going to be a gallery show in your future. Because you're starting to go down this path, it sounds very familiar.
There's a show right now. Do you know the Nickel Museum, the National Center for Children's Illustrated Literature?
I've heard of it.
Texas.
Yeah. Oh, I've been there actually.
You've been there. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know this at all.
It's really, there's a whole story behind it that's so cool. But they put together a show every year of an illustrator's work, a children's illustrator's work, and then it's up in their gallery for 6 months or something, and then it travels for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So right now my artwork is in Orlando. In the gallery in Orlando, and it was in South Dakota, and I can't remember where
else. Is it just a show, or is the work for sale? Like, can people buy originals of your work?
Yeah, it's just a show. But my work is for sale at the R. Michelson Gallery in Northampton, Massachusetts.
I've been surfing that website this whole time. Looking at all your pieces.
Hey, will you send me that link, Jake? I want to see that gallery.
It's in your texts.
Oh, okay.
They have. So they're great. And if any of the listeners or viewers are ever in the Northampton kind of Western Mass area, that's Amherst, Northampton, Five Sisters College area. There's the R. Michelson Gallery and the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art are there, and well worth, if you're in the area, you gotta go. If you're an illustrator in the
These are all so good. I mean, there's so much work.
Let me ask you, you know, Grand Canyon won an honor, Watercrest won the medal. But those, just because other people picked those books as the ones that were worthy of the award that year, doesn't mean they're your favorite.
Yeah.
Do you have do you have a favorite book that you've done, or a favorite illustration from the books that you've done, where you're like, man, that was it. That's, I was firing all cylinders on that one.
I'd say I have an illustration. There's like usually one in every book where I'm like, I feel really good about it.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes it's more than one, but
okay. You know, exactly. I know what you mean.
Yeah. That I'm like, that's the one where I nailed it. And I
got the face right. I got the lighting right.
Yeah, I'm just trying to keep everything close, everything else in the book close to that. Mm-hmm. Right. But that's being an artist and being self-critical.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So there's that. And then books have different lives. There's the life of the book when you're making it, and your relationship. I say lives. I have a different relationship to the book when I'm making it. So my book, might be behind. There's a book I did about the Galapagos Islands called Island. Mm-hmm. And that one, for whatever reason, was a joy to put together. There was no major roadblock. There was no major like mental struggle where I felt like I wanted to throw the whole thing out. Usually there is. Other artists will be familiar with that. So that was that. Now, after the book is out, it becomes, you know, a story. It becomes all the reader's book too, right? It has a different life. And I would say that Watercress has you know, it's different than the nonfiction books I do. And that story has reached people who really needed it. And I've heard from people about what it meant to them. That was really, really special. So it's just for the viewers, it's a story about immigrants. And so they're Chinese immigrants in the 70s and kind of about growing up in with a foot in two cultures. So the protagonist has this experience and then has to work through it. And, you know, adults have written to us saying, that was my experience and I never knew anyone else felt that way. And kids have said to me, you know, like, it sparked discussions about being poor, or I don't want to say being poor, but there's a lot about thrift in the book because the family doesn't have a lot of money. And people, kids will say, oh, you know, we have to me, like, I have to get used stuff too. And it's given them the opportunity to express something that they don't often get to talk about, or maybe feel ashamed about talking about. So that, like, you know, that is very meaningful. And then there's just the fact that, you know, you get tired of talking about books that have been around for a long time. So the new book, my new book is my favorite one to talk about right now.
Let's talk about it.
It's about hurricanes.
When did that one come out?
It came out in, I wrote this one. It came out in May, right before hurricane season, which was important.
Perfect.
You don't want your hurricane book to come out after a devastating hurricane.
Right.
You want it to come out before.
Right.
A lot of the book is about preparing for hurricanes.
Is it like a singular family that it focuses on? Like, oh crap,
there's
a hurricane.
So there's, so there's the hurricane. There it is.
That's great.
And it's coming. So there's three stories. There's the story of the hurricane, the story of the meteorologists, and hurricane hunters are in here too. So they're predicting the hurricane, and then their forecast reaches Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, and the family there is preparing for the hurricane. So there they are, just learning about it.
That's cool.
Is this total fiction, or is this based on the
actual family? It's nonfiction, but the story and the hurricane in it is fictional, and the... yeah, so the story in the book is fictional. It's based on basically three storms that hit, Cape Hatteras, one of which continued on to impact Vermont. And so there's like kind of a connection there about, you know, that information there. Hurricanes don't just impact the coast. They keep going. And then flood, you know, especially now they're wetter than they've ever been, flood places far from the coast.
What made you want to do this book?
It was the suggestion of my editor. I had another project that I had proposed, and we were actually close to having a contract signed for it. And then I found out that a friend of ours was doing a book on the exact same topic. And we were like, that's not going to work out.
Right. At least spread them out.
Like
a few years apart from each other.
It was, do you know the author, Brian Floca? Brian Floca. So is Brian Floca. And he and I do very similar books. We write and illustrate books about science and nature, nonfiction book, picture books.
Because he did he won the Caldecott. Like for 2 years ago, right?
Yeah,
for Locomotive.
Yeah.
That's right. We should get him.
So I was like, okay, well, like, we can't, Brian, it doesn't make sense for Brian and I both to have the same book coming out. Let's rethink this. Point. Maybe my book can be about that topic, but in a different angle. And then my editor said, well, what about hurricanes? And I said, you know, let me do some research and see what I, you know, you want to be passionate about the topic. I want to be passionate about the topic before I go into it, or have some sense that it will be meaningful and exciting to work on, right? I don't want to be like, take a topic because my editor liked it, and I'm like, it's a bear to work on. But I started reading about hurricanes, and I got really interested in the meteorological side of things and how they're predicted and how they're forecast and how people stay safe. And that whole science of that is just really cool. And the physics of the physics of the weather, the physics of hurricanes.
Did you do any storm chasing?
I did not do storm chasing. I'm not, my tolerance for risk has gone down exponentially every year, every birthday. I'm like, I have less tolerance for risk, but, I am grateful to, the people who do fly into hurricanes to predict them and do that work. And I think the people that just do storm chasing to take a video that they can then sell to the news. Mm-hmm. There's like a whole groups of people that make that their freelance.
What a weird job that would be.
It's I think it's crazy. I don't advocate for it, but I'm very grateful for their footage because it helps me a lot. Reference.
I love that stage of a book where you are starting to learn a topic, you know, that might be in the book or some kind of theme. Yeah. And you start doing this research. It's my favorite part of the book, maybe more so than illustrating the book. It's like just starting to learn about this new thing that I never really thought about or some angle I didn't think about. I remember I wrote this book a long time ago. It got into acquisitions, but never got published. But it was about this kid who wants to set a world record. I did this gallery show of people who set weird world records. And so I thought it would be a cool book. And so I wrote this book. And then as it was going through acquisitions, I thought, you know, I've done all this research on world records and stuff. I want to set, if the book gets published, I'm going to try to set a world record for the launch. And so then I went down this whole like path of...
Yeah, that's cool.
So the world record that I wanted to set, although the publishers I was talking to said this is a bad idea, but I wanted to set a world record for the most world records attempted but failed. And so I would be the only person who got in there for not doing something, but anyway, it never got.
You should have done the highest book launch. So tie your book to a rocket.
And there you go.
Launch, I mean, actually launch it.
There is some of the weirdest.
I wrote a book called Gravity, and it's around here somewhere, but. I'd hold it up if I could reach it. But anyways, the title is just Gravity. And my idea for the book launch was to get a bunch of kids to go to the rooftop of their school and throw the book off.
Nice. Well,
the librarians didn't like that idea.
Yeah, we are not going to put a bunch of kids on the roof.
bring kids to the book to destroy books, but to the roof to destroy books. But I thought
maybe they
funny.
Could throw a paper airplane off or something. I mean, anything's going to fall. So it is what matches the topic, I guess. Yeah. Right. The last book, the most recent book is about hurricanes. Can you fill us in on sort of what project is next, or is that under wraps?
It's not under wraps. It's been announced. I'm working on a sequel to Watercress.
Cool. Yeah. Watercress 2.
Yeah, Electric Boogaloo.
Return of the Watercress.
it's been great. It's interesting. You kind of alluded to the fact that it's very different from my other books. And because I normally do nonfiction about science and nature. This book stylistically was a little different as well. Kind of a looser watercolor, different. I used a hot cold press paper, so there's a little more texture to the paper. So I find like this summer, this fall, I've been trying to remember how I kind of painted that one so that I can do it in the same style. I'm definitely getting there, but I've never done a sequel that's like specifically a sequel.
Right.
Same. Is it going to be the same characters and you have to revisit them?
And that's the big thing is, like, you know, I did that one in 2022 Caldecott Metal, mm-hmm. published in 2021. So I did the art in 2020.
Yeah. So it's been a while.
And so it's been a while since I've drawn that character. And I'm like, oh.
Is the character older in the second one, or is it as a continuation of that similar time frame?
Similar time frame, same time frame.
Okay, yeah. That's good. At least as you so, can, because I don't have to somebody like right. 2 or 3 years. That's really yeah. hard.
Yeah, I in my skill set, I would say my one of my weak points, or one of the things I struggle with the most, is character consistency. Mm. I've it's never. Hard. It's hard.
And you're not like, alone.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, I didn't come out of, like, us. I came at art from kind of like a, I don't know, the Syracuse University, Rockwell, Pyle, NCYF, kind of, you know, way of making art, mm-hmm. which is more painterly or whatever, more realistic painterly, and not kind of the cartooning or animation side of things where you learn to simplify shapes, mm-hmm. and
which build from basic shapes up to something.
Yeah. I learned like. All right, memorize how to draw a skull. Then, you know, then memorize where the muscles go on that skull, and then lay skin over those muscles.
Oh man, yeah, that's the hard way around. Right?
And,
then, tough.
And then, you know, and go from there. And it's great training, but it's not. It's made it, I think, harder, a little harder for me to find that character consistency. I don't know. Yeah. That's my experience.
It's a tough subject. One of the ways that I'm trying to, I also deal with that same problem. And I realize that, you know, making a book takes such a long period of time that from the first opening spread to the last one, I might be slightly shifted. I'm a different person 6 months later, yeah. You know,
like, and 25 pieces of art later.
Right. So what I'm trying to do now is go through, make all the dummy or, you know, do all the sketches for the dummy and sort of get the general position of the character on all the pages and what that character is doing. And then literally do a character sheet from the book, like where I'm just drawing all the positions that a character is going to be in the book. And because I'm working digitally now, I can just drop it in because it was all made at the exact same moment.
Right. Yeah. So it's when I did Hurricane, I did all of the, there's all these scenes of satellite view of the hurricane with forecast cones superimposed over top of it. So I did all of those at once so that the.
Perfect.
The same colors, same.
Right.
Their style. Like,
right. I don't think a lot of people realize how hard it is to do that because it's such a long, long period of time that it's in development that it is, yes, it can be months between paintings that people are going to thumb through in seconds, you know? So,
right.
But
right,
for
right.
us, it's kind of hard. Well, we should probably wrap at some point. Sure. Yeah, it's, we've been going about an hour and a half.
I didn't get to ask you my question.
Oh, no, please do. Go ahead.
No, it's fine. It is fine. I was just going to ask, because Jake, you do, you come at it from the comic mm-hmm. and cartooning side of things. Is any of this different for you in terms of, book development or character consistency or that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I'll tell you, working in animation, that was like my first career. You learned a lot of the animation way of doing things. So you just pick up, number one, you're not alone by yourself in your studio working every day.
Yeah.
You're in a room of 15 to 20 of the best artists you have ever met in your life.
That's
awesome. And different ages and experience too. And so every day you're just picking up little things. Oh, how'd you do that? Oh, how'd you do this? You know, every time people are showing, you know, we have weekly meetings where people show the work they did the week before and the director, you know, make that nose bigger and do this. And you're just, I don't know, it was such the perfect thing for me to do because I never went to art school. I just sort of stumbled my way into animation. And so when I shifted over to children's books and comics, I took that sensibility with me of doing the concept art and doing the character model sheets where you actually like figure out the character first and then refer back to that as you're drawing it. Not to say that I'm perfect at it or the best at it. I'm still like, I'm filling up a sketchbook right now with faces and heads because I realized I had atrophied in that regard over the years. And so, you know, there's this constant, the thing I love about art is you don't age out of it like basketball or football or something. Like, yeah. You just keep learning and keep getting better, almost like a musical instrument or something. So,
yeah.
So as long as you're the mindset that you have, like, I'm going to learn from Lee White, or I'm going to, you know, go take this other workshop here, or I'm going to ask Jake about this or anything to improve and to get better is like, I think the way forward for like the perfect artist career, you know?
Yeah.
And then just letting that go back into your work. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. 100%. Yeah. Hey, that's the only thing that's what keeps it interesting for me is learning something too. It's not like, oh man, I have to learn more today. It's like, although I do feel that that idea that sometimes things atrophy, you know, that I do feel that.
If you don't do it, you lose it.
It's not, there's two feelings that I always get like that. It's one of this thing atrophying that I haven't done in a long time. And the two is I see so much great art now between Pinterest and Instagram that I'm always like, oh, I want to be doing that. It's always a tug to something else that I'm not doing.
That's the danger, right? Mm-hmm. That's the danger of it.
I think though I love that we personally had a good 20 years, 25 years of our life without the internet. Because all of our upbringing was, and if you're like me, you were starved for illustration growing up. Yeah. Like anytime, if you wanted to see an illustration, you had to go out into the real world and procure it. Like go to the magazine aisle and find, you know, even like
the Black Book that would come out every year, the Illustrated Black Book Communication Arts Illustration Annual was like such a huge moment every year when that thing came out.
Right. And I remember anytime we went to the mall to get like school clothes or, you know, whatever Christmas shopping, I'd be like, I'll be at B. Dalton Books. You'll know where to find me. And I'm just cruising through looking at all the book covers, looking at all the children's books and all that stuff. And so you have that background where there's this thirst for images, but also this very, very finely curated, like every image that was in your life was curated specifically. And now you have like this deluge of illustrations.
It's too much. It's
all over
much.
The place all the time. And so I think it's good to kind of sit back and go back to that age of like, okay, let's revisit, you know, 20 classics and just soak in that for a little bit and let that be the thing that influences us. And then we can go back out and find some more stuff.
That's such good advice.
That's a good advice.
Yeah. Anyway. So good.
All right. That was Jason Chin. Great guy to talk to. I'm so glad you set this up, Lee. That was awesome. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we?
Yeah, it's just such a pleasure to talk to him. He's so earnest and forthcoming about, you know, where he is, and he's a lifelong learner. He wants to advance his career even after winning a Caldecott and an honor Caldecott. He's just going for it, and he's a true artist. It's fun to see that.
The other thing that struck me about him is he really is a team player. Like he mentioned that the editor he'd been working with left to go to another publisher. And instead of saying, see you later, he's like, I'm coming with you. Wherever you go, I'm coming with you. When he won the Caldecott, the Caldecott is an illustration award. So his author didn't get an award for the Caldecott because it's not about the writing, but she was able to get a Newbery silver medal, right? And so, he's like, he didn't want to take full credit for the book, even though it's a picture book and he's the illustrator. He's like, well, it's not my story. Right. I was just helping bring her story to life. So it's just cool that he's so willing to, he's so humble about the work that he's doing. So
I'm the opposite. I'm so not humble that every year I hold a mock Caldecott just around my own house, and it's only my books. So that's
that's hilarious.
It's a 100% win.
And there I did it again. I won, even though I didn't even do a book this year.
I'm just using the Caldecotts as paperweights at this point because I have so many.
Yeah, that's hilarious. All right, well, I'll take us out here. Everybody, thank you for joining us. 3-Point Perspectives made possible by SVS Learn, where becoming a great illustrator starts. Your hosts today were myself, Jake Parker, and Lee White, my compadre here. And, of course, we had Jason Chin here in this interview. Just a shout out to our team that makes this podcast and everything we do at SVS Learn possible. Special thanks to Daniel Tu, our producer, Preston Smith, our team manager, Austin Shirtliff, our keeper of the community, Lily Howell, our show notes wrangler, Lisa Fott, our chief operations officer, and our illustrator, and Elise Black. Now, go draw something.